Okay, so we're a cozy group. That's good. We can have time to discuss together. What I wanted to share with you today is actually a journey that I've been on the last couple of years with this particular story. And it was stimulated by an article that I was reading whilst on holiday in Nepal. And I was sitting in a very comfortable hotel lounge room where we love to go with a warm fire. I had nice, helpful Nepali staff running around getting my tea just exactly how I wanted it. And they've learnt exactly how that is after the last 20 years of going there. So very comfortable. And I read an article and a story that was extremely uncomfortable. For a lot of my Christian life, I've really been struggling to live by God's principles, and particularly, as those of you who know me well, around the areas of social justice and how we live out our faith in that way. And that not only comes from my Christian background, but from a strong Labor Party upbringing in the days when those two things could be in the same sentence. Perhaps less so these days. So it's always been a strong part of my family tradition to be considering others and to be looking at the injustices of the world. Working for TIER for 8 years, working and living in Nepal, and even in the communities that I now work in. And so my apologies right up front for sharing with you not a solution but a challenge. And I'm hoping that you can help me on this challenge, and I'm hoping that we can support one another in this challenge as well. The article and the story that so challenged me is a story by Ursula Le Guin, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with her writing, but she's normally a science fiction writer. This is a very short story of hers, and it's called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And it features a city that is in an undesignated place. We never know where it is. But this town, this city, is beautiful. It is where everybody is happy. And in the particular day of the story, there's a lovely festival happening. Everyone's smiling and laughing. Life is good. Life is good for all the people of the village or the city. And they have delightful music, they have wonderful parks. Everyone is genuinely happy. They enjoy their magnificent buildings and they enjoy their lovely farmers' market. And on the day that this story occurs, there's a festival, there's lots of lovely beer flowing, there's horse races, people are laughing and passing out flowers. The young men are giving the young women flowers to wear in their hair. And people sit and play and have music. It's an idyllic and magical place. But there's one thing about Omelas that everyone knows. In the basement of one of the buildings is a cupboard or a room the size of a closet. And in that closet is a child, and that child looks about 6 years old, but actually the child is 10. The child has been starved, has been ignored, has been ill-treated, has been left in their own excrement. It is obviously socially challenged because nobody ever comes to talk with the child. The child is fearful, malnourished and neglected. And the truly awful thing about this is that everyone in Omelas knows about the child. Around the time of adolescence, everyone is taken to see the child and they know it's there. They know all about it. So they are not in ignorance of the child. But they also know that their happiness and their lovely, magical, fantastic life depends on the fact that this child is there and that this child lives like this. And so people are faced with a dilemma. What do they do? And there have been, in the story, there are two responses. Most people are appalled. They're shocked. They think it's terrible. But they think, well, if this is the price, this is what we have in order to have our life, then this is what we will do. And they go back up into the magical village and live their lives. There are a few, however, and they are the ones who walk away, for whom it's so appalling they can no longer live there and they walk away. Now, it's just a story, and I guess the challenge for me as I sat there in my comfortable hotel was, who am I in this story? Well, I'm not the child in the basement. But there are three possible interpretations around this story. One is the story of exploitation, that our lives are based on the exploitation of others. And we can see this when we look at malpractices around manufacturing and so on, and whether we look at how we purchase our clothes and ethical things, ethical purchases. Around asylum seekers, where are they coming from into our lovely world? We keep out those who are suffering from other places in order to protect our lifestyle. For me, the challenges around exploitation were much sharper, much closer to home. Do I enjoy cheap holidays in poor countries? Do I have an addiction, hobby, but to cheap silver jewellery purchased in places that have a much lower lifestyle than I do? You can see I'm getting very personal here. Another interpretation is that of the utilitarian thing. We need to compromise for a greater good. If somebody needs to suffer in order that the rest of it, everyone else can live a great life and have things go well, that's maybe a price we have to pay. And we see this lived out in employment situations. We need to sack the few so that the majority can still have a job. How often do we hear that? Again, the need that we need to control the population size of Australia so the rest of us can continue to live or have a good lifestyle. Even in church teaching, I think, the role of Jesus as the scapegoat is in somehow, you know, this is a suffering that God had to inflict on one person in order that the rest of us could be viewed as sinless. And that has been promulgated in Christian circles for a long time. And I don't know what that says about the sort of God we think we have. The third interpretation around this story could be that actually it represents the tussle that goes on in our own psyche, that we have our normal life that we all want to live and we must live, and yet somehow or other we have a moral sensitivity that evil exists. So none of this particularly helps me understand how I should be doing things. I just found the story completely and deeply challenging. The dilemmas are really, really easy to identify for me. My cheap holiday in Nepal every year, my silver jewellery, my access to luxury. I guess if I'm looking to who I am in the story, I'm not one of the people who walked away. However much I'd like to think that might have been me. What are my daily compromises? What am I not prepared to do to prevent others from suffering? What don't I do, and therefore what should I be doing? This is the challenge that has sat with me for the last 2 years. And I'm hoping it by now is sitting with you. The next challenge that this story identifies for me is, where do the ones who walk away go? They're the goodies of this story, in my view. Maybe not in yours, and it is just a story. These are the ones that our best selves want to be. We would love to be. Yes, we were the people who walked away, who could not compromise on the suffering of that child. But what happens to them? The story doesn't tell us. We don't know. They take a huge step into the unknown, which is a step of faith. What happens? What are the alternatives? History in all sorts of traditions have shown alternatives to people who can't stand the way we live, the challengers who are looking for something that is morally, ethically, and even spiritually more just. We've seen the monastic movement in Christian traditions. In India and Nepal, we see sadhus, the holy men, probably in Bangladesh too, I don't know, but they walk around, they've completely renounced family, material possessions, and they walk around, people give them alms, and they in some way are seeking perfection and holiness, but they have eschewed the world. There are traditions of hermits in all sorts of stories and traditions, holy men of all kind. Even in our own society, we have people who just seem to opt out. They're just completely outside the mainstream in all sorts of ways, good and bad, but they've just opted out. The environmental movement and social activist movements are in some ways a response to the injustice, either to the planet or to others that people have responded to, this dilemma. And my question is, has the Christian church really been an alternative way? Are we a group that has walked away and done something different? I've got the next. Oh, sorry, I'll just turn over here. It's not this long. It's a nice big font. There are biblical options around what to do, and I'm sure you're familiar with many of them. We've got the prophets who just rail against injustice and in some ways reflect some of the traditions of the holy men, the sadhus, the hermits in some ways, and other ways they have also just been the social activists of the day. In Micah, I think he sums up the call of the prophets with the act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. The Beatitudes, which I had Bevan read to you, refer to a whole alternate way of being, poor in spirit, being those who mourn, being the meek, hunger for and thirst for righteousness, merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, those that are persecuted because of righteousness. And it talks about our reward being in heaven. And I ask myself, do I truly believe that, and can I wait? Or am I still trying to seek the comfort and happiness of this world? And is that wrong? What does it mean that your reward's in heaven? And then I also come back to the seemingly huge challenge and difficulty of actually living out the Beatitudes. In John 17, there's the whole discussion with Jesus about being in the world but not of the world. So we're coming a little bit different here. We're not walking away. We're being in the world but not of the world. And also in Philippians, there's the whole discussion about how Jesus left God on high, came down and lived among us and joined us in this messy, awful, imperfect, suffering world. He didn't come actually to take us out. So that leaves me with the challenge of the compromise. I'm here. How do I do it? What do I do? And how do I deal with the guilt of knowing that in this world are people who are our child in the basement? How do I do it in a way that still has integrity, that still reflects what God is calling me to? Richard Rohr, in his book Eager to Love, which is the story of St. Francis and St. Clair, and I guess they were wrestling with the same things. St. Francis came from a life of luxury. He was one of the elite. And I'm going to read the passage here. This is from Richard Rohr reflecting on the life of Francis and Clare. Francis and Clare were not so much prophets by what they said as in the radical system-critiquing way in which they had lived their lives. They both found their inner and outer freedom by structurally living on the edge of the inside of both church and society. Too often people seek either inner freedom or outer freedom, but seldom, very seldom, in my opinion, do people find both. But they did. Francis and Clare's agenda for justice was the most foundational and undercutting of all others. A very simple lifestyle outside of this system of production and consumption, the real meaning of the vow of poverty, plus a conscious identification with the marginalised of society, the communion of saints pushed to its outer edge. In this position, you do not do acts of peace and justice as much as your life itself is itself peace and justice. You take your small and sufficient place in the great and grand scheme of God. By living on the edge of the inside, I mean building on the solid tradition, but doing it from a new and creative stance where you cannot be co-opted for purposes of security, possessions, or the illusions of power. You're on the edge. It is worth repeating that Francis and Clare placed themselves outside the system of not just social production and consumption, but ecclesiastical as well. Remember, Francis was not a priest, nor were Franciscan men primarily priests. Theirs was not a spirituality of earning or any seeking of worthiness, career, church status, moral one-upmanship, or divine favour. They represented in their own unique ways the old tradition of holy fools among the desert fathers and mothers of the Eastern Church, and offered that notion to the very organised and efficient Western Church. Maybe there's some clues there for us. Are we living on the edge of the inside, or are we captured in the heart of the happy village? So, no real answers from me, which is what I said at the beginning. But what I want to do now is to take some reflection time. This is just a story, and it's not even a Christian story. It's written from somebody who is just grappling with the injustice of the world. So I'd like to take a few moments now to be asking, what are your personal areas of compromise and therefore challenge? Who are your children in the basement that you know about and are taken to see and somehow you're able to live with? How do you cope with the idea that there are those suffering for things from which you benefit, things that I benefit? Are there changes that you want to make? And if so, what would they be? What stops you? What are the ones that are still too hard to make? How can we support one another in this? Let's just have some moments of silence, and then it would be lovely if people felt free to discuss. You don't need to disclose your deepest and darkest, but let's support one another in this. So let's be silent for a while. Okay, do people have any comments that they would like to make or questions? Lisa.
So just a few quick things. First of all, thank you for sharing that. I found it really uncomfortable and important to be contemplating things like that. Stories are a great way of illustrating things in a way that's a little bit removed from your own personal life, and so there's lots of value in that. And then there's always limits with places Absolutely. Where it doesn't quite apply. And so one of the things on my mind was, why did they walk away? Why didn't they break her out? And there's lots of kind of complex layers around that, and I think that's something we contemplate in our own lives. When do we just say, I'm not going to be a part of that? And when do we say, I need to change that? They're different things. And the other thing is more of a question, thinking about that idea of the cheap holiday overseas and sitting with the guilt of that. I don't really understand what the solution is to that in terms of, well, if I choose to not have a cheap holiday, how is that actually helping? And I'd be really interested if anyone has any sensible answers to that, because I don't understand or I don't know.
Yeah, no, and for me, as somebody who, A, loves life, gets a lot of joy out of my life here, you know, I've too found this whole thing deeply confronting, but used it as a tool to be reflecting on areas in my life where perhaps I hadn't thought about before, not necessarily to condemn and say, that should never happen, but it was a challenge to say, look at your life, Lyndon, really look at it. And it's going to be different things for different people. And there's a sense in which I know going back to Nepal for Michael and myself has a whole other dimension to it that I don't think is wrong. But nevertheless, I need to confront within me, there is still that part of me that is benefiting from the poor lifestyle of others and the economies. And as you say, the solutions are really hard in terms of global politics and trade rules and you know, that locks out poor countries, all of that. The question for me is to not live comfortably with that, but to be continually seeking. That was, and I'm sharing this as a personal thing that happened to me reading this story and wondering if it could be of value to others. It may not be, but yeah. So yes, all of that. Who's next? Greg?
Me. I find I have the, and sometimes I have the opposite problem, that I can just cast my eye across, you know, 5 metres of that wall and I can find 10 different things where my mind runs off of, like, how am I benefiting from all of the different injustices that have resulted in me having this wonderful building to be in and people and clothes and I can get absolutely lost in it.
Yes.
And, yes, I can look deeply at my life, but I think I'd probably stop living it if I did that too much.
Yeah. Did the thing of Francis and Claire, that living on the outside, inside of the edge, rather than kind of being swallowed whole by it?
Yes, and this whole... your whole presentation this morning has just... I feel a warmth coming to here and knowing that when I'm out at the shop and surrounded by all these things that I don't know how to make an ethical decision, but I know there's a whole lot of other people that I know
that are
faced with those same challenges, and I find that comforting.
Thank you. Yeah. Trish? Sorry, then we'll get across to the other side.
Yeah, thanks, Lyndon. You've actually put your finger on something that I'm finding really uncomfortable and frustrating, that I'm aware of a lot of injustices that I would love to get involved in dealing with, particularly in the food industry.
Mm.
But I find myself in a situation where I'm busy dealing with something else that God has given me. And most of you know that I got to a point earlier this year where I said, no, I'm leaving, I'm out. Mm. I was one of those people who wanted to walk away.
Mm.
And God actually said to me, no, you're staying here. Mm. And he assured me that he was going to use me for something that he wants to achieve in that situation.
Yeah.
It's mighty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm finding it really heavy going, but I'm just hanging on to that message that God wants me to stay there and use me in some capacity, and all those other things that I want to sort out are just going to have to be above the horizon or beyond the horizon until whenever.
Yeah.
But I find it really frustrating.
And I think that comes back to, and we can get ourselves bogged down and completely immobilised to what God is calling us to do. And for me, this was just that deep... I think as the thing from Richard Rohr was saying, you know, we need to be peace, we need to be justice rather than do acts of. And it's not so much about all the things that we get involved in, but about who we are as people and our relationship with God in that. I think there are too many causes, there are too many things for us to be on top of everything. But we can have that heart for justice. We can say, and for peace, that heart for God. We can say, I will walk away from the primary thing that that drives this world, which is production and consumption. In a way that owns our heart. And I'm not saying that, you know, economics is bad. But there is a way where it can capture you that I think... No, our heart should be captured by God and who he is. And then it's how we live in this world. And I agree that the biblical thing is not to walk away. God clearly didn't walk away. He sent his son in. And that's the hard bit for us. Bobby?
Yes, I found the story terribly unsatisfying because maybe I'm used to the 3-point sermon where there's 2 bad ways and 1 good way. But
yeah. Wasn't a good way. In the world.
As I see it, the people who walked away were just as bad as the people who stayed there.
Well, we don't know what they did, whether they walked away and came back or anything. We just know they walked away.
That's right. But, you mentioned clothing. One of the problems I have with buying ethical clothing, and I know of a place that makes ethical clothing, is it's expensive and it's edgy.
Yep.
And most people can't afford it. But the thing is, you have no choice. It doesn't matter if you go to Myers, Target, where you go, the stuff's made in China. And I think that's just appalling, and I try to avoid it. And the same with furniture is, if I can get furniture made in Australia and made in Western Australia, I will. But I recently helped my son buy IKEA, and for heaven's sake, I mean, that's worse still. It comes from Europe. It's even further than Asia. So in that sense, we're surrounded by an environment where we depend on the polluters. I mean, we buy plastic, we buy steel. We live in places that have got most people do, have got concrete base on them. All these things that are environmentally damaging, but at the same time, they're giving somebody a job.
Yep.
So, you know, you've always got these tensions, is it? There.
Yeah.
If you always lived in second-hand houses and bought second-hand clothes or whatever, you would never give anyone any work.
Yeah.
So to me, giving people a job is a very important thing.
Absolutely.
I suppose that's one way that I help solve my conscience in that sense.
That's right, and we do need to think about it. I mean, one of the things that I wrestle with, I'm sixth, seventh generation Australian. My family received a land grant in Lane Cove. Now, if you watch the ABC series on that, you know, on which, you know, not that we're a wealthy family, but, you know, that's my inheritance. I have benefited from that. I cannot change that. There's nothing I can do to change it. And I don't in any way think we should be wallowing around in guilt. And that is not, if that's the purpose, if that's what you've got from this, it's not. It's just challenge us and say, what are we taking for granted? What are we not looking at in our lives that we need to look at? You know, is there anything I need to change? That for me has been the journey. Ken? Oh, sorry, John.
For some reason, is on. For some reason, I'm reminded of the story of how Bob Hawke lost his faith. Bob Hawke, of course, was the son, one of two sons of the Congregational minister in Leederville, and he became president of the Australian Young Congregational Youth Association or something.
Mm.
And in this capacity, he went to India and there was a big conference and all sorts of, you know, fancy food was laid on and Bob Hawke was enjoying himself. And then he went for a walk down through the slums. And the contrast between the wealthy Christians and their luxurious food and the starving people in the slums, his response was that he lost his faith in Christianity. Other people would have had a different response, but yes, the way people respond is... Well, I find that story very sad.
Yes, thank you. Ken?
Actually, the interesting thing about that story is Bob actually came back and asked for a jumper from everybody at the conference and he went out and distributed them.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is that I agree, living in this world feels like making a Faustian pact quite often. But the bit that you didn't say about the story, that I imagine about the story, is that what people might not have realised is that little boy had a precious gift for them that was more precious than all the wealth that they were wallowing in.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the rich young man who said, what wonderful thing do I have to do to inherit the kingdom? And Jesus turned it on his head and said, if the love of God creates in you the urge to do something wonderful, fantastic, but if you think you have to do something in order to get the love of God, you are knackered. Yeah. So that's, for me, that's the crux of it. My sense is, how do you live with that? You live, as you say, outside this mainstream and treat every person in front of you as if they are the living presence of Christ, because that's what the people who we hold up like the Mother Teresa do. And pray a lot. Get your relationship right with God. Mm. Find out how many hours it took to create that silver. Compare it to what you earn per hour. Find out what the cost of that represents in the capacity to live. Find out. I was talking to a truck driver just recently. I'll shut up soon. I was talking to a truck driver just recently, and he said he was back to Bali soon. And his family were being entertained by a Balinese family in the village. And I asked him why. He said many years ago the guy that came in to make their beds at one of those resorts, he was a nice young bloke. They got talking and he knew that the guy invited him back to the village. Found out the guy wanted to go to college to get some qualification, and for him, living in Australia as a truck driver, albeit not a wealthy man, it was financially easy. The gift was he created relationship with the family in the village, yeah. And now every year their family is entertained and given the preciousness, yeah, of relationship that money cannot buy at a resort in, yeah, Bali. And I imagine you might get some of the same in Kathmandu.
For sure, for sure. Lindy's got a comment down here. Then we might stop.
Two things that come to mind for me. One is that we try as best we can to make our choices about where we go, what we do, whatever, knowingly. So we find out about things. What we do with that knowledge is different for everyone, as Lyndon said. It might totally overwhelm us. It might make it clearer to make a decision. And the other thing is that we try and see the positives as well as the things that just seem too hard and how could we ever do anything to change that. We see the positives and we see what's at our doorstep and take our little steps.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to leave it there. And I'm still, I'm still on this journey of trying to know how to be in the world but not of the world. And that was what some of the songs earlier were about. And know that there's no easy, easy answers. But I go forward knowing about the child in the basement. I know that this now will be part of how I think about life, that I can't live it in ignorance. And can I say, I think this church's response and people's concern for asylum seekers, to me, our nation's attitude to asylum seekers is very much to keep them out so that we can continue to enjoy our life, and that what we are doing and in being counter to that is a very visible way of saying, actually, we're going to walk away from that point of view and do something different and be something different. Thank you. Thank you for my apologies for maybe being a bit too heavy this morning, and hopefully you will have found it helpful. And hopefully I look forward to your support of me on this journey. Thank you.